Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 90-year-old Purple Heart recipient remembers the sinking of the USS Hornet.
One of the bombs came right down the elevator where we were. Shrapnel from the mess tables hit me right in the eye.
Hear what happened to him and how he survived. He was also on the Hornet when it launched Jimmy Doolittle and his Raiders for their famous bombing of Tokyo. Don't miss Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9. Brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes, where each week we get a little history lesson on the radio, not from someone who read about it in a book or watched a documentary, but from people who actually lived it. Veterans, primarily from our World War II generation, clue us in a little bit as to what they went through. If you've heard the program before, you know all this, but just in time for Memorial Day, we're welcoming in some new listeners this week. I'm really excited. We have a couple more stations on board. KNZR in Bakersfield, welcome Kern County. Or maybe you're catching us from the Central Coast today on KVEC. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you come back for more next week. Here's the deal. The veterans I have on this program, they don't want to be called heroes. They tell me, to a man, that the real heroes of World War II were the 400,000 Americans who did not come home, those represented by all the gold stars, the ones we remember this Memorial Day as those who paid the ultimate price for the sake of our freedom. I get that, but I've also learned in my travels that no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done some pretty remarkable things in the service of our country. Our greatest generation is quickly leaving us, so it's important to honor these brave Americans while we still can, to preserve their stories so their service, their sacrifice, they're not forgotten. And along the way, I know that the rest of us were educated. I also believe we can be inspired in our own lives by what they've encountered in theirs. So if you're new to Hometown Heroes this week, now you get it, I think. And with Memorial Day upon us, we'll hear from a survivor, a man who was aboard one of World War II's most noteworthy aircraft carriers when it went down in the Pacific in October of 1942. The ship was the USS Hornet. 140 of her crew were lost that day, and for a while, this man's family believed he was among them. No, he didn't die that day. He was wounded, and we're going to hear the whole story from 90-year-old Bob Cole of Fresno, and maybe he was your teacher once upon a time. If you grew up in Firebaugh or Riverdale or Fresno, he taught at junior high schools in all three of those cities, so maybe you remember his smiling face, or maybe it wasn't smiling if he was your referee on the basketball court. He's got some of those stories, too. But we're going to go way back before you ever knew what the San Joaquin Valley was. You grew up in a town called Odo, Iowa. How big is Odo, Iowa?
300 people.
Wow, that's a big city.
Two stop signs.
What was life growing up for you in Odo, Iowa?
Well, it was pretty poor, and you had to play basketball and baseball, but no football because you didn't have enough people, not enough boys. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to college, and I ended up joining the Navy because they said I get a year of college for every year I'm in the service. So I signed up for 4 years.
And this was before Pearl Harbor?
Before, this is in August of 41.
Why the Navy as opposed to another branch of the service? Was it because you didn't have much water around Odo, Iowa, or what?
Well, two reasons. One, because only the Navy recruiter came to our school, and I believed in, if I'm going to go to war, I want to ride, not walk.
And did you understand from the things that were going on in the world at that point, was it clear to you that maybe America would be at war sometime soon?
Didn't have any speculation at all that wars. All I was interested in is get my 4 years in and get go to college. But lo and behold, it happened.
Not exactly the way you planned it. And so you join in August of 41, and they take you from a city of 300 to Great Lakes Training Station, which is just outside one of the biggest cities in the world there.
I mean, I want to comment on that. The largest building we have in Odo was a grain elevator. We get Liberty out of Great Lakes, and I got in Chicago, and I was on Michigan Avenue, and all of a sudden a drawbridge goes up, And I'm standing there in awe, seeing the Tribune building, and horns are honking at me, get out of the street. I almost got run over because I couldn't believe this bridge going up and a boat going through.
A lot bigger than a grain elevator, huh?
Oh, man, I tell you, especially the Tribune building. No, Tribune, excuse me.
So it was a real eye-opener for you.
Real eye-opener. And then when I graduated from the Great Lakes, they sent me to Norfolk, Virginia, on board an aircraft carrier Hornet, CV-8, by the way, because CV-12 was in the museum in Oakland now, you know.
Yeah, this is one of our newest museums up in the Bay Area is the USS Hornet, but some people don't know there were two of them, and the first one sank while you were on it, so we're going to get that story. What was your first impression of the CV-8, the Hornet? How big a ship was that? That's probably bigger than Odo.
Well, when I went aboard there, we had 3,000 people, 3,000 sailors, mm-hmm. and that was a culture shock, coming from 300 people to 3,000 people, and seeing this great big ship. The only thing I've ever seen was a little boat going down the river. And so we didn't have any airplanes, you know, because all the airplanes were, when they did get on there, were propeller-driven and not jets. We didn't have any guns when war broke out, and so we hadn't even been commissioned yet.
Well, that begs the question, what do you remember about when the war did break out? Where were you on December 7th, 1941, and how'd you hear about it?
I was in Norfolk, Virginia, on board the aircraft carrier, and we heard it from our captain over the loudspeaker. Then afterwards, you know, the news flashes all over, so we heard it from the radios also. From there, we went, got all our stuff in a hurry, and they shipped us to, went through the Panama Canal and went to the West Coast in Alameda, and that's where we picked up Doolittle and his airplanes.
Yeah, this is pretty historic stuff, but I'm curious what it felt like to you as a young man, because here you are, I guess you would have been 19 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. You're away from home. You're on this aircraft carrier, and all of a sudden now there's a war going on. What did that do to you emotionally, mentally? How did you process that?
First thing we did, we all gathered around and prayed in our own department and hoped for the best of us. And to me, I never experienced anything like this before. I never, you know, I read about World War One, but I never visualized we're going to be in a war. And I thought this is going to be 4 years of, like the Navy says, come and join the Navy and see the world. And I didn't get to see the world very much.
Not all the parts you wanted to see anyway. And give us a sense of what your duties on the ship were.
I was a storekeeper, and what we did was did the payroll for the sailors on board. We also operated the, what they call a concession stand, where the crew could come in and buy candy or ice cream, cigarettes. By the way, cigarettes were 3 cents a pack. It was no taxes. And I didn't smoke, so that was my duties as payroll and helping run the concession stand for the crew.
It probably made you a pretty popular guy on that ship.
Oh yeah, because we weren't open very often. You know, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, and different people would run it. I enjoyed every bit of it.
So you mentioned going through the Panama Canal and then around to the West Coast, and you picked up Doolittle and his pilots. Now, this was just unheard of at the time. Everything they were doing was crazy. The deck was not designed to have B-25s fly off it. They had to modify the B-25s to get them to take off in such a short distance. But I'm curious what you guys, as a crew of that ship, knew about this whole thing. What did you see happening, and what were you starting to figure out?
Well, at first we didn't know we were going to go to Japan. We just knew that they told we have a mission. They're not going to say anything because they didn't want anybody know what we're doing. And so all we knew is we were taking them to some place, and after we left the United States, we found out where we're going. We weren't too excited about that. You know, going to war, are we going to last my 4 years or what? What if I get sunk?
Those questions would be answered eventually. Was there a buzz on this ship about these 16 airplanes and these pilots and crews that were aboard?
Very much so, especially when we got to Alameda and they found out what we're going to do. Like you say, number one, how are they going to fly off this thing? Because there's no jets or anything like that. And so it was a buzz. I mean, it was really talked about, hoping that whatever mission we're on, that it would be a good one.
And I think pretty much everyone in every theater of the war had their mail censored. But were you guys given specific instructions not to say anything about this development?
That's right. We were told everything. Don't you write back home or anything like that. Don't mention anything about it. Just carry on the conversation, a normal one. We made sure we wrote home and told them that we're alive, but we couldn't tell them what our missions were, though.
There's a lot of material that's been written about the Doolittle Raid. There are movies that have been made. They just had a reunion of the last few surviving crew members of those planes. And one thing that I've always found interesting was the timing of the whole thing. And it's somewhat similar to D-Day, where the timing they planned wasn't the timing that happened. And they ended up leaving early because they thought the Japanese had spotted them. Did you experience any of what was going on there when they actually took off? Did people find out? Did you see them taking off?
One of my guard duties at night was to man the 5-inch cannon and also look out at night and see if he saw anything. And then the pilots would come out and visit us. They can't smoke because of a little teeny light would be seen. And also we were told that we were going to go within 600 miles of Japan, Tokyo. But at 800 miles, they spotted the sampans. And we knew the sampans had walkie-talkies, or whatever you want to call it. So that's when they had to adjust their plan. So instead of taking off at 600 miles in Tokyo, they took off at around 800 miles of Tokyo. We're on what they call general quarters. And so in my case, I didn't get a chance to see them take off because my general quarters were different from my regular yard duty. So we didn't get to see them take off at all.
But I'm sure you heard about it.
Oh, yeah, we heard. We heard those big, I mean, they're a lot louder than a little F-16 or an SB bomber taking off by the...
You hear those two engines of the B-25 going, and you know something's happening. Do you remember, and maybe this wasn't the case, but were people speculating aboard ship on what might happen to these planes and whether they thought they'd make it where they were going? Did anyone have any idea what they were doing?
No one knew, and I don't think anybody expected them to be... anybody come back alive, because if, you know, ground fire, did they have enough gas go all the way to where we didn't know where their destination was after they did their bombing? So
they didn't really know either.
No, that's right. That's right.
That's what makes that story so incredible, that these pilots and these crew members really did sign up for a suicide mission, not knowing where they'd be able to land, if they'd be treated well. And it's amazing that they did as well as they did. When you've heard that story over the years, what's been the most impressive or inspiring aspect to you about all those planes and what they were able to do and the fact that so many of them did make it?
Well, it really, when we learned about it, you know, because they told us, the captain came over with a loudspeaker and told us all these things that happened. They didn't know, you know, 100%, but they told them that so far it's 75% good so far. Uh-huh. Now it's 80% good so far. And then they told us about a couple of them didn't, you know, I don't know how many went down, didn't make it, but I read the story, so we were very elated on the outcome.
So I imagine somewhere in that announcement on the loudspeaker, he said, those B-25s bombed Tokyo.
Yeah, they bombed Tokyo, and most of them made it out of there all right, and they're on their own. There was a few casualties, and, you know, made us feel real good that we had a part of it.
And the way history remembers that raid is not so much that the actual physical damage was a huge blow, but that the emotional power of what happened there was significant, not just to the Japanese, who now suddenly felt vulnerable, but to America, to say, you know what, you hit Hawaii, well, we hit Tokyo. What did that feel like for you guys on the ship after having experienced Pearl Harbor, knowing what happened there, to hear some of our planes just bomb Tokyo?
Well, we felt real good about it because Not the eye for eye or tooth for tooth business, but the idea that if you attacked us, you're going to pay for it one way or another. And this is a good example of how we were payback time.
So that's how Bob experienced it. You've probably heard a bit about the famous Doolittle Raid on Tokyo, launched from the deck of the Hornet on April 18th, 1942. And of course, America learned about it through the newspapers, on the radio, and from newsreels. So let's take a time machine back to 1942, if we can. If you had gone to see a movie at the then brand new Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo, or one of the Fox Theaters in Bakersfield, or Visalia, or Hanford, or the historic Warner's Theater in downtown Fresno, you might have seen this newsreel from Castle Films, the headline, Yanks Bomb Tokyo, and the commentator, Basil Rysdale.
Packed on the afterdeck of the Hornet are 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers. Never before have these huge planes been launched from a carrier. High explosive and demolition bombs are made ready for the destruction of military objectives in Japan. Colonel, now Major General Doolittle, with Captain Mark Mitcher, commander of the aircraft carrier Hornet, who was once decorated by Japan, now gives his medal to be returned to the Japs on the tail of a bomb. Not until they are miles at sea do these men know definitely the mission for which they have volunteered. Closer and closer they approach enemy-controlled waters and the danger of discovery. Suddenly, a strange vessel is sighted. It's a Jap patrol boat, and the task force intends to destroy it before a warning can be radioed to Japan. A lifeboat goes to pick up Jap survivors. It is feared they have flashed the news to heavy Jap naval forces in the vicinity. Survivors are picked up and brought aboard. Jimmy Doolittle asks Admiral Halsey to go in closer for another hour and a half. And now the signal is flashed for the takeoff, 10 hours ahead of schedule.
And we're going to get back to that newsreel, but right now it's time for our first break. More on the Doolittle Raid and more from 90-year-old Bob Cole, who was on the Hornet when it happened, when Hometown Heroes continues next, right after this. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 90-year-old Bob Cole, originally from Iowa. He lives now in Fresno, California. But in 1942, he was on the USS Hornet when Jimmy Doolittle and his Raiders made history. We left off right in the middle of a newsreel from the period, so let's get the rest of that historical perspective now.
Doolittle pilots the lead plane. There's a breathless moment as the big bomber gathers speed. It's airborne. The first Army bomber ever to be launched from a carrier is safely in the air. Now they know it can be done, and they time their takeoff with the upsurge of the bow of the carrier in the heavy seas. Secret Norden bomb sites have been removed from these planes and replaced by a makeshift device costing about 20 cents. These historic pictures round out the electrifying news of Tokyo's first taste of American vengeance in April 1942. Loaded with eggs of destruction, they wing through a fog-ridden dawn. The planes sweep in without being discovered. They separate into groups to attack the several objectives carefully selected by means of accurate intelligence to ensure that only targets of military value will be hit. Colonel Doolittle himself has told of flying over the Emperor's Palace and refraining from bombing it, though he could have left it in ruins. Here are the last pictures to come out of Tokyo before Pearl Harbor. They show the Japs rehearsing with all the realism possible for air raids, which they assured the Emperor and people of Japan would never be experienced. The defense system, as they practice it here, proved disorganized and panic-stricken when Doolittle and his men catch them flat-footed. Not a single shell fragment hit a plane. The loss of face by Tokyo may well have driven the Japs into the disastrous Midway expedition and its staggering losses of ships and men. Later, in China, the flyers who bailed out safely are decorated by Madame Chiang Kai-shek. The smiling Jimmy Doolittle does not yet know the fate of some of his comrades.
No, he didn't. He would later learn that 11 men were killed or captured, three of them executed by the Japanese. All of the aircraft from the Doolittle raid were lost, but the emotional blow for America had been struck. Doolittle, who once feared he'd be court-martialed as a failure, was given the Congressional Medal of Honor. So that's a little big picture view of what we're talking about, thanks to that 70-year-old newsreel there. Back to one Hornet sailor's account now as we visit with 90-year-old Bob Cole today. Last question about the Doolittle Raiders, and feel free to add anything else that comes to your mind. Did you ever interact with any of those airmen that were on your Navy ship?
The pilots, like I said, they'd come out in the evening where I was standing duty, and we conversed. Sad part of it is I had a lot of pictures taken with the pilots. I had a picture taken with General Doolittle, and I lost them all when the ship went down.
You had that film in your locker?
I had a film in my locker, plus my $2, plus all my clothes.
Was there anything else that you want to say about Doolittle and that raid and what it means to you still today?
You know, I feel honored that I had a little tiny bit to do with that raid, just a tiny bit, because all the things should go toward Doolittle and their crew and how they, all the time they spent practicing how to go off an aircraft or someplace else. I think that was great for their part.
The thing that wasn't so great for you, they were gone and they had their own survival things to deal with, but what they did made your ship a target. The Japanese knew the aircraft carrier that had launched those planes, and that meant there was a bigger price tag on the Hornet's head than just about anybody else. Did you guys realize that at the time, that you were marked?
No, you know, it's quite an incident, because out there where we got sunk, we weren't the only aircraft carrier that got sunk out there.
You're talking about October 1942, not far from Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands. There were Japanese ships headed for Guadalcanal, and the Hornet and another carrier, the Big E, the USS Enterprise, met the Japanese in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands. What were you doing, Bob, while all this was going on?
My job during the battle is we were on the second floor in the forward mess hall. And what we did was put the bomb, the vanes and fuses on the bombs and send them up to the hangar deck or flight deck. I don't know if you want me to go on with that.
Yeah, I don't think very many people have put fuses on bombs, especially not during a war on an aircraft carrier. So I think you have a pretty unique story to tell there.
This is on the second deck in the forward mess hall. There were 35 of us down there in that mess hall, and we chipped up the elevator as fast as we could. And what happened, the Japanese bombers came off the island of Guadalcanal, which they own, and they just kept bombing us and bombing us. And we didn't have kamikazes hit us. You know, they hit right at the flight deck and hit where the motors and all that, the control tower is. And one of the bombs came right down the elevator where we were and exploded. And the shrapnel from the mess tables hit me right in the eye, right here, and they cut my eye down, lowered my eye down, so I lost my eye, my vision and everything else, and we lost the elevator, and out of that 35, only 12 of us came out alive, I don't know why, and then all of a sudden we over the loudspeaker, it says, abandoned ship, and how in the world we're going to get up there, so we crawled up the ladders to the hangar deck, and then we had to jump into the water, and I happened to find a towel to hold my eye up like this, because it was just laying down by the skin underneath here, and an optic nerve that held it from just going out altogether. And I had two big holes in my back from the shrapnel, so we abandoned ship, and I stayed in the water for about 45 minutes to an hour before I was rescued, because, you know, all the people were abandoning. The destroyer Mustang came up and picked me up. Then they took me into the dressing room. And they sewed my eye up with no anesthetic, so I was in such a shock. From there, they took me to the French island called Noumea. Also, we had a hospital ship, Solace, S-O-L-A-C-E, and I was put aboard there. And that's when they were determining what to do with my eye. They weren't worried about my back, and my back hurt more than the eye. But 3 days on board the ship, hospital ship, there was a cargo ship going back to San Diego. So we drew straws who was going to go back. I happened to draw a good straw, there were some married couples there. Married people wanted to say, I'll give you $5,000 for that. I said, well, I'll never see you again, buddy. I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. So I went back to, about, took us about, I think it was 2 weeks or so before we got to San Diego. And then we put in the San Diego Naval Hospital. And I stayed there for almost 8 months. My parents were given a letter saying that was a MIA, you know, missing in action. Because nobody knew where we were, you know, all their, everything's in uproar.
Man, there's so many questions about this. I didn't want to interrupt you because it's so captivating, the story that you told. But I'm going to backtrack with you and kind of take you through some of those steps along the way. So at the time that you guys got hit, you were on that second deck putting fuses on bombs?
Yeah, putting a fuse and bomb and vanes on the bomb. And then we'd ship them up in the elevator to the hangar deck or flight deck, probably the hangar deck first because they couldn't put the planes on the hangar deck up to the flight deck until the planes on the flight deck took off. And then...
All of a sudden, this explosion happens.
Bomb came right down the elevator, which we used to go up and down and ship the bombs, and they exploded. And happened to be in the forward mess hall. The tables are all aluminum or something like that, and they just scattered and then shrapnel hit every all of us.
So all of the explosive material and shrapnel within the bomb was added to by all this metal material inside the room. I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and understand what that felt like. Because, I mean, this is sudden and intense, I imagine. What did it feel like?
You know, I was in shock. Looking around and also seeing how, you know, we told to abandon ship, find out where the ladder was because, you know, I'm not normal. And then seeing some of my good friends dead and find out where the other ones who were not dead so we all could go up, you know, one at a time, the ladder, and it's, you know, it's chaos.
And your left eye is hanging out of the socket, just hanging on by a thread.
By the skin underneath and an optic nerve, one optic nerve there.
You're wounded in the back.
When they took the shrapnel out of the holes in the back, whatever the utensils they use, they could see my rib. Yeah.
You had to be in a lot of pain.
Oh, well, when you're in shock, you don't know what I was in pain, very much so. Then I had to jump in the water.
Well, you had to get up to where you can jump in the water first.
And also, I had to find a life jacket.
And you probably can't see very straight with only one eye.
That's right. Blood is rolling all over the place. There, your camaraderie is great because people are helping each other. They grabbed me, you know, and led me to where I'm supposed to jump, and we jumped together so I wouldn't go someplace else.
That's not a jump in a wading pool. This is, I mean, they've got a show on TV the last few months where people are diving off a high dive. This is higher than that, I imagine.
They say it's around between 40 and 60 feet. And thank God I wasn't on the flight deck. So that's higher up.
Yeah. Did you have to hold your eye in while you jumped?
I did because I had a towel. I found a towel when I was there, and some guy might have found it for me. And I lift my eye back up and then hold the towel like that and held it all the time was there. And they said, make sure when you do get in the water, make sure you float on your back because your back has more protection than your stomach does. Your stomach is just old fat.
And this may sound like a dumb question or a dumb series of questions. Were you scared? Did you think you were going to die?
Very scared. Very scared. You know, I've never been through anything like that. I'm a little farm boy. Never even had guns around our house or anything like that. So I don't think about, you talk about a life lesson. I probably learned more the 4 years I was in the Navy than I learned 4 years in college about life. I'm not talking about books now. I'm talking about life. I learned everything. I learned things I never even envisioned I'd ever know, you know, or have to do. I'm not the only one, you know.
The phrase trial by fire takes on new meaning when we hear a story like yours. So you've gotten out of the fire, out of this sinking ship, but now you're in the water. And there are all kinds of things to worry about in the water. How long were you in the water?
Anywhere from about 45 minutes to an hour.
How long did it feel like?
Eternity. But I looked around, I said, I'm not here by myself. That's the best part of it. If I had to be there by myself, I might have just turned over and said, the heck with it.
How many did you have with there? Do you remember any of them?
On our ship, because there's a lot of ships out there picking up people out of the water. I would say it was about 20 in my particular area.
Did you have anything to help you stay afloat?
Yeah, your life jacket, that's all. That's all. And, you know, you paddle, dog paddle or something like that.
And I want to get back to your story and how you recovered and all that, but how often over the years, and it's been more than 70 years since this happened, how often do you think about those shipmates of yours who didn't make it?
At first, I didn't think too much about it because I was thinking about myself. In fact, after I came back and went through college and I was teaching, they thought I had post-trauma, and they sent me to a psychiatrist and all that, even after when I was teaching. And, I feel sorry for those people, but life goes on, you know. And I met other people because after I got out of the hospital, I had another adventure. Because what they wanted to do was give me a medical discharge out of the hospital. And I said, no, I don't want one, because I signed up for 4 years because I want a college education. And this is the only way I'm going to get it. So I don't want a discharge. So they put on my papers that I could never be shipped outside the continental limits of the United States. So I was put on recruiting duty. Uh-huh. I was sent to St. Louis and recruiting aviation cadets. I never thought about teaching, you know, because I was a social studies major and a PE minor. And I was put in St. Louis. We live in private homes. I go out in Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, recruiting at the high schools, just like that guy recruited me.
And this is while the war is still going on.
Oh, the war is still going on, yeah. And I recruited aviation cadets. So when the recruiting was closed up, I was sent to St. Olaf College in Northville, Minnesota. Anybody know about Northville? That's where Jesse James robbed the bank. Anyway, in this small town south of Minneapolis, there's two colleges. St. Olaf is for Navy cadets. On the other side of the river was a Carleton College for Army cadets. And so I was sent to St. Olaf, and that's where I taught English and math. I didn't know I wanted to be a teacher, but by recruiting and going to all these high schools and teaching there, and then when that closed up, I was sent to Miami, Florida, Opa-locka Air Station. It's quite a coincidence, down by Miami, there was a hurricane coming in, so we had to take our papers with us and stay in a hotel until the hurricane was over. Then I stayed at Opa-locka Air Station, and when my 4 years was up, I said, it's time to go.
Well, that's impressive that college education meant that much to you, that they're giving you your discharge. You said, no, I want to serve some more. And I'm curious, when you're out there recruiting guys, the war is still going on. In fact, the war's getting worse and worse if you look at it from a casualty perspective. How often did you talk about what had happened to you?
Well, I gave them the whole story, what happened to me. And I said that, but remember, my story is only one. And here's a chance for you to do what I meant to do. I want to go to college. Now, here's a chance for you to go to get a free college education, learn to be a pilot, because if you do survive the war, most of the pilots go on to be pilots for United, you know, all the airlines.
So would you say you were a pretty good recruiter then?
Oh, I thought so, because we had a lot of them at St. Olaf.
So none of them ever said, hey, it almost killed you. Why do I want to go do that?
No, they didn't say that.
As far as the recovery, so... I mean, you get picked up, you know, maybe I didn't spend enough time on that. How great did that feel to get picked up out of that water?
I thought they were never coming. Look, there's, 3,000 people in the water. Count the other ships and all that people. How can they handle so many people? I thought, well, when I saw that ship coming towards us, we all hollered, hey, over here. You know, you've seen that on TV, haven't you? Uh-huh. Hey, over here, I'm over here.
Best thing you ever saw?
Oh, man. Better than ice cream.
Well, that's saying something. I have two daughters, so in our house, there isn't much that qualifies as better than ice cream. It's break time again, but there's more to Bob's story, and we're going to explore it after this. You're listening to Hometown Heroes, where we're proud to support Honor Flight Kern County, Central Valley Honor Flight, and the entire Honor Flight Network. Here's World War II veteran and former U.S. Senator Bob Dole with a word about that.
Hello, I'm Bob Dole, speaking for the Honor Flight Network, and asking for your help. America owes a debt of gratitude to the 16.5 million World War II veterans who, without doubt, helped save the world. Today, the ranks of our most senior heroes are dwindling. More than 1,200 of these heroes die each day. Those in their 80s and 90s lack the means to safely visit the National World War II Memorial, which honors their service and sacrifice. Every week, the Honor Flight Network flies veterans free of charge to Washington to see firsthand the National World War II Memorial erected in their honor. These veterans are flown to Washington from all parts of the country. Your generosity will help continue the Honor Flight program for these greatest generation veterans. And I urge you with all my heart to give whatever you can.
Explore how you can get veterans from your area to their memorial by visiting honorflight.org. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Returning to the story now of 90-year-old Bob Cole, a Purple Heart recipient for wounds suffered in the sinking of the USS Hornet in 1942.
And you talked about being in shock when that bomb hit and you're hit in the back and your eyes hanging out. When did that shock wear off and when did you realize what had happened to you?
I think the shock wore off was when I was on board the hospital ship Solis. They had more trained doctors, because when you're on board like that destroyer and you're moving and you're the operator, you know, he's trying to do the best he can, but you're still under fire and you're moving. And so when I was aboard the Solis, the hospital ship, you know, they're standing still, they're not moving. In fact, they wanted to take my eye out and give me a glass eye. Thank God that cargo ship came along, because what am I going to say? But they know more medically than I do, and so I figured whatever they say is going to happen. So I was very fortunate that I still have my same eye, but little by little, I can distinguish day and night. And once in a while, I can see a hand, but if you put one or two or three, I would never see that. So
you see fine out of your right eye, but the left eye has never been the same since.
No, and the right eye that's why I go to the Veterans Hospital here every 4 months, and they give me, I put drops in my eye, and DMV wants 20/40, but the best I can get is 20/50. And the DMV say, that's good enough for me. Uh-huh. So far.
Well, I know you covered a lot of miles all those years of refereeing basketball, and that I have to go there because it's too ripe for the picking. What is the biggest criticism about referees every year, that they need glasses or they can't see? Did you ever have some people heckle you about your basketball reffing?
I said, hey, I got both eyes, but I only see out of one. And then a lot of times they razz you, and then I might say, I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
If they only knew what that eye had been through, that it would be heaping coals on top of their heads, I'm sure.
Most of the coaches, you know, we might meet at the bar, mm-hmm. and we have good times. And I remember one time when I met at the bar, and I put my glasses on, and this coach's wife says, why the hell didn't you put those glasses on while you're refereeing? I said, I might have seen too much, and it caused the game to go longer.
Yeah, we don't want that whistle blowing too much. So you said, was it 8 months in the hospital?
8 months. There's a comic side of that, too, you know, because I had both eyes covered all the time because they didn't want to have the strain on one eye. But if you wanted liberty whenever you're able, you had to do one or two things. You either polish all the brass in your area or go to the zoo and clean out the zoo pens. I said, well, I'm not going to the zoo. I've been in the zoo all my life. Out in that water, that's the zoo. Yeah. So I didn't go much liberty. No, either that or I just polished the brass.
8 months is a long time. And your back's healing up, your eyes healing up. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
Well, I told you before this, you know, I never had a chance to call my mother to let her know where I am, because I knew I was listed as MIA. When I was able to get to the phone, when they allowed me to use the phone, I called my mom, and told her, she's in shock. She hadn't heard anything from me.
She thought you were dead.
Yeah. In fact, they had a funeral for me. That was before I called her. And I called her, and she's, oh, God. Well, she had a sister living in Glendale, and so she immediately called her sister, and her sister came down and visited me once a month. That was something. But, it was lonely. You lay there, and you can't see because your both eyes are covered. In fact, when I was going to college, and my wife and I was all covered, and I had a biology class, and I had to trace the blood from the start to the finish in your heart. And I couldn't read a book, so she would read it to me. You go from this vein to this ventricle, this ventricle, this artery. I pass it.
And that's what I'm wondering, because, I think it's obvious to everyone listening, it's pretty remarkable that you survived when so many did not that day. So in all this time where you're recovering, you got your eyes covered, you can't see anything, you're in a pretty helpless situation. Did you ever think that you would get married someday, that you'd have a daughter, that you'd have grandkids and great-grandkids?
Never even thought about it. All I thought about is getting healthy, get back on my feet, go to college. I really wanted to go to college. Because all my friends at Odo, they came from pretty rich families. When I say rich, I mean they're better off than we were. And they're all going to college. And what am I going to do? There's no jobs in a town of 300 people. You got two gas stations, two grocery stores, a bank, the post office. That's it. I felt lonely, hoping someday to get back to normal.
And it was a good thing you went to college, not just because you had a great 30-year career as a teacher, but because that's where you met your wife.
I met my wife, and we were married 62 years before she died of dementia.
You want to tell us a story of how you met her over there? Did she feel sorry for you because you couldn't see, or what?
No, believe it or not, I'd rather play poker than anything else, but we played cards at the Union, because neither one of us had much money. See, I was living off in the Navy, and we played cards, bridge, and then we'd go from there. We might go to the shop. We'd order a Coke and two straws. Get ice cream, we get two spoons. Yeah. So it was very, very, very wonderful woman.
And I'm curious, as your career in education went on, did you ever bring up your war experience? Did you ever share that with anybody?
No, never. Kept quiet. To this day, I don't belong to the American Legion. I don't belong to VFW. I don't belong to the Purple Heart.
Why not?
I don't like to be around people, and all they're talking about is war stories. I have my own, and I get tired of hearing the same. I don't like to hear war stories. Yeah. That's why I don't join those groups. I've had opportunities after opportunities. Sure. I'm sure they would help me get more benefits than I get. But I'm satisfied. Like I tell my wife, and she says, what did you do with this? And I said, I don't want to talk about it.
And you keep your Purple Heart, the same one you got nearly 70 years ago, tucked away. Do you remember when they gave it to you? Was it a general that gave it to you, or how'd you get it?
I tell you how I got it. I didn't even know I had it. I was at the University of Iowa, and my mom called, and she says, guess what? I said, what? Some Navy people came to the house and they presented the Purple Heart to you. I didn't know I had it. So when I went home that weekend, I got to see the Purple Heart.
What does that mean to you?
It means that they gave me some credit for the time I spent and the parts of my life I gave up. It means a lot to me. They say I should have other medals, and I said, I don't care about it. My main thing is my health.
So I know you can't do this. It doesn't look possible, but if you could go down to the bottom of the ocean and find the wreckage of the Hornet, what would you try to get out of there? What went down with that ship that you wish you still had?
I like those pictures I have with Doolittle, and the pictures I have with him, the pilots. Any souvenirs that I got when I was in Hawaii, there's not much I had. Being a rookie, a petty officer, you don't have many things.
When you think back about it now, you think of the guys from your ship that died and the fact that 400,000 Americans died in World War II. How grateful does that make you for your own experience?
I feel very, very fortunate that I'm alive, and I never thought I'd get 90. Maybe I'll get 91.
Well, you better. I'd love to send you to Washington, D.C. to see that World War II memorial here. Is there something that you think people today, you've got grandkids and great-grandkids, people that weren't alive during World War II, here. I think you're pretty good at this because you went around recruiting guys to go serve in that war after you were wounded in that war. What do we need to remember about that today? Why is it still important today?
Well, it's important that I think that here in the United States, we got men and women who will stand up and fight for our people, and that people that didn't go into service, when they see a service woman or a service man, they shake their hands or say, thank you. To think people who didn't want to go or didn't get a chance to go, but they are so grateful for people who do, the ones I know. I'm not speaking for everybody, because I know there are people out there that think it's terrible that we even go into war. I wouldn't advocate that for anybody. But in my case, I wanted to go to college.
And you did. You sure did. And since you brought it up, on behalf of everybody listening, I do want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it, because I know it's not easy. You know, you said that they thought you might have post-traumatic stress. Is there anything about that you feel comfortable sharing that you've had to deal with in the years since the war? Have you had nightmares, flashbacks?
You know, I there for a long time, and like when we were teaching, you know, planes go over from the airport, they go over and you have to stop teaching. But when those planes go over, I had to shudder and think, boy, the last time I saw planes, I heard planes go over, it almost cost me my life. And I had those at night, you know, especially around here. The Clovis helicopter comes over some 1 or 2 o'clock at night, and I know Clovis West. They come, and I raised up out of bed, even today, because they come off a low, and that's, I don't know if you heard them, they come low. And that's why I went. I went to the psychiatrist. They sent me to there, the Veterans Department, and they tested me and everything, and I guess I just didn't have it.
That's just something that you just had to deal with.
I deal with, that's right. That's you hear that all the time.
When you think back of all that, think how close you came to dying, how the gravity of the injuries that you survived. Do you feel like somebody was looking out for you? Why do you think you survived?
Oh, yeah. I know God was looking over me. And number two is I was in the right place at the right time, especially down there when only 12 of us come out alive out of 35. I must have been standing in the place where I got hit but didn't get killed. And those other, they were in the wrong place. And I feel very fortunate. And life is the way it is, so I feel very, very fortunate. I'm very active and enjoy life. I enjoy my great granddaughter. She's 5, going to kindergarten. I watch her on T-ball on Saturdays. Uh-huh. So I'm very fortunate. I'm enjoying life.
Well, I've sure enjoyed hearing a little bit about it. We've covered some heavy stuff today that I think a lot of other veterans and veterans' families can identify with. So let's close with something a little more lighthearted, or maybe for some of our younger listeners, a little eye-opening too. Bob, in your years of teaching and officiating sports, you've encountered some of the best athletes that Central California has produced. And there's one guy who went on to play a little bit in the NFL. Then he had a TV career. He starred as Bubba in The Heat of the Night, if you remember that. And he became the mayor of Fresno, so some people might know him that way. What's the story? You had to spank Alan Autry when he was in junior high?
Junior high, yeah. Yeah, that's how he introduced me to people, too.
This is in Riverdale when his name was Carlos Brown. He was what, seventh grader?
Seventh grade.
He was your quarterback on the flag football team, but what did he do that got him in trouble?
Oh, he took a board eraser and threw it at a mouse running across the floor. And
why'd you let the mouse in the room? What were you thinking?
No, we didn't have enough people in the room. And it ricocheted and hit one of the girls in the head. And didn't hurt her, but hey, pay for your crime.
This was back when corporal punishment was allowed, huh?
That's right. Too bad it's not allowed now.
So you had to take a baseball bat and give him a few whacks, or what?
You have a broken baseball bat, uh-huh, and you cut it in half and make a flat board and put holes on the end of it. Mm-hmm. Have them bend over and touch their ankles, and not the girls now.
Yeah.
If the girls, they had a different punishment for them, but boys, they knew it.
So has Alan ever thanked you for that, because that's what got him on the straight and narrow?
No. All he says, I was in his room.
Yeah,
he's the nicest person I ever met.
Well, you're not so bad yourself. And, you know, we always hear on Hometown Heroes about how different things were in the past. That's a difference in the classroom we hadn't really explored here before. That's a new one. 90-year-old Bob Cole of Fresno, California, has been our guest today. You can see some photos of him on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're about out of time on the program for today, but thank you so much for listening. Next week, as we approach the 69th anniversary of the Normandy landings, we're going to focus on D-Day and hear from some folks who were there on June 6th, 1944. So you don't want to miss that. And this Memorial Day weekend, it's all about remembering, right? So I hope you'll also remember to thank all the veterans in your life for their service to our country. That's Hometown Heroes this time around, and I'm Paul Leffler reminding you that freedom is not free.